24. The impact of the disinformation program. The shaping of Western assessments of the communist world. The launching of a strategic disinformation program in 1958 invalidated the conventional methodology of Western students of communist affairs. A carefully controlled flood of information was released through the whole range of sources under communist control. As in the NEP period in the 1920s, this flood of information confused and distorted Western views on the situation in the communist world. Western analysts, lacking the ability to acquire inside information on communist strategic thinking, planning, and methods of operation, gratefully accepted the new stream of information at face value. Without their knowing it, their conventional methods of analysis were invalidated and turned back on them by the communist strategists. Because of the deliberate projection by these strategists of a false image of the dissolution of communist unity, the non-communist world ignored or undervalued open and significant evidence pointing to bloc cooperation from 1957 onward on a new footing of equality and commitment to fundamental ideological principles and long-term policy objectives. The new dispensation allows for variation in domestic and international tactics and provides unlimited opportunities for joint efforts between bloc countries to misrepresent the true state of relations between them whenever this should be to their mutual advantage. Unnoticed by the West, communist ideology was freed from its Stalinist straitjacket and revived on Leninist lines. The change was successfully misrepresented as the spontaneous replacement of ideology by nationalism as the driving force behind the communist world. Non-communist studies came increasingly to be based on information emanating from communist sources. While observers in the non-communist world sometimes showed some awareness that information was reaching them through channels under communist control, there was virtually no recognition of the fact that the information had been specially prepared behind the Iron Curtain for their benefit. The political role of the intelligence services was ignored, and since the evidence of planning and coordination in the activities of the bloc was also overlooked, the growth of internal opposition movements and the eruption of disputes between communist states and parties were wrongly seen as spontaneous developments. Up to 1960, and despite the Tito-Stalin split of 1948 and the Polish and Hungarian uprisings of 1956, the non-communist world was willing to accept as fact the growth of a cohesive communist bloc and international movement. Some Western analysts, like Professor Pausini, regarded the decisions of the 81-Party Congress in November 1960 as indicating the adoption of a long-range policy. But the acceptance at face value by Western statesmen, diplomats, intelligence services, academics, journalists, and the general public of the subsequent evidence of disputes and disunity in the communist world precipitated a new attitude that would have been unthinkable before and that caused the views of Pausini and others to be regarded as anachronistic if not antediluvian. The 81-Party Manifesto came to be regarded as a temporary, patched-up compromise between the parties signifying their failure to adopt a common policy and so was brushed aside. The evidence of evolution and splits in the communist world was so overwhelming in volume and so convincing in character that none could continue to question its validity. Acceptance in particular of the Sino-Soviet split as a reality became the common basis for all non-communist attempts to analyze present and future policies and trends in the communist world. As a result, Western perception of offensive communist intentions was blunted and the evidence of coordination in the execution of worldwide communist strategies was discounted. Because strategic disinformation was not recognized as such, Western views on internal developments in the communist world came increasingly to be shaped and determined by the communist strategists in the interests of their own long-range policy. In the Soviet Union, the dropping of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and the introduction of market-oriented enterprises and other measures of economic reform seemed to presage a reversion toward capitalism. The gradual rise in living standards seemed to be taking the edge off the Soviet appetite for revolutionary change, generating new pressures on the regime to allow greater freedom and improve the supply of consumer goods. Apparent differences in the Soviet leadership between the liberal reformers and conservative ideologists on how to grapple with these pressures and reconcile the need for progress with lip service to ideology confirmed Western belief in the recurrence of power struggles, mainly behind the scenes but sometimes in the open, as in the case of Khrushchev's dismissal. When the liberals appeared to have the upper hand, expectations were aroused of increasing cooperation between the Soviet Union and the West. Moderation in Soviet propaganda and expressions of interest in peaceful coexistence and businesslike negotiations seemed genuine, especially when compared with the implacable hostility of the Chinese. Occasional aggressive Soviet actions were attributable to the survival within the leadership of a group of diehard Stalinists who had to be appeased from time to time by the liberal reformers. If the Stalinists were once more to regain control, détente would be reversed, and there might be a Sino-Soviet reconciliation. The West therefore had an interest in strengthening the hand of liberal reformers. Provided they survived, there were prospects of an improvement in relations owing to the existence of common interests between the Soviets and the West in avoiding nuclear conflict and confronting Chinese militancy. In the long run, the technological revolution offered prospects of a gradual narrowing of the gulf between the communist and non-communist systems. Such were the arguments of the 1960s. Despite the revival of neo-Stalinism toward the end of the decade, the arguments survived and gained weight until the later 1970s. The apparent opening up of cracks between the communist states was assessed as an encouraging development. The emergence of a range of different brands of communism seemed to show how ideology had lost its binding force. The rivalries between the communist states appeared rooted in traditional national sentiment. The impact of the Sino-Soviet dispute on Western thinking can be illustrated by the change in attitude of Alan Dulles, the former director of the CIA. A man of unquestionable integrity and anti-communist conviction with access at the time to all available open and secret information. In an address delivered on April 8, 1959, Mr. Dulles said, "As long as the principles of international communism motivate the regimes in Moscow and Peking, we must expect that their single purpose will be the liquidation of our form of free society and the emergence of a Sovietized, communized world order. They change their techniques as circumstances dictate. They have never given us the slightest reason to hope that they are abandoning their overall objectives. We sometimes like to delude ourselves into thinking that we are faced with another nationalistic power struggle of which the world has seen so many. The fact is that the aims of the Communist International with its headquarters in Moscow are not nationalistic. Their objectives are not limited. They firmly believe, and eloquently preach, that communism is the system which will eventually rule the world, and each move they make is directed to this end. Communism, like electricity, seeks to be an all-pervasive and revolutionary force." One only 3 years later, speaking on the same subject at the convention of the American Bar Association in August 1962 in San Francisco, Dulles, in referring to the unfolding Sino-Soviet dispute, maintained that the communist system was showing manifold vulnerabilities and weaknesses. Point two, confirmation of this view was soon visible in the growing independence of Romania. Following Tito's example, Ceausescu seemed to be championing his people's cause against Soviet interference in their country. He was therefore worthy of support in concrete terms. Similar aspirations and tendencies toward independence from the Soviet Union were thought to be at work elsewhere in Eastern Europe, especially in Poland. But it was in Czechoslovakia that the newest and most exciting brand of communism burst upon the market in the Prague Spring of 1968. This seemed more than just an assertion of Czech and Slovak nationalism. It was a rethinking of some of the basic concepts of the relations between the individual and the communist state. It was socialism with a human face. And it opened up new possibilities of East-West cooperation. But because it threatened the foundations of the communist system, it was crushed by brutal Soviet military intervention. Apparently shaken by rebellion outside their borders and the growth of dissidents at home, the Soviet leaders under Brezhnev reverted to repression on crude Stalinistic lines. It was therefore with reservations that the West received communist proposals for a conference on European security. Nevertheless, the Czechoslovak experience had, it seemed, demonstrated the existence of liberalizing tendencies in the communist world, a point underlined by vocal Soviet dissidents. It was therefore worthwhile for the West to engage in discussions on European security and human rights, even if only with an eye to the future. Tito and his Yugoslav regime were thought to be helpful in promoting liberalizing tendencies in the Bloc. Yugoslav influence in the non-aligned movement was welcomed as an obstacle to the extension in the developing countries of Soviet and Chinese power. The tendency toward disintegration seemed to have spread from the Bloc to the international communist movement. The Sino-Soviet split had triggered off a splintering process in many communist parties. Soviet intervention in Czechoslovakia had been repudiated by several important parties, including the French and Italian, the two most powerful in Europe. In the mid-1970s, both parties had expressed their independence of the Soviet Union and added their voices to the cry for democracy, human rights, and a Europe free of military pacts. Even if the Italian party came to power, it seemed that that might not be incompatible with the survival of democracy or even with continuing Italian adherence to the North Atlantic Treaty. To sum up, the apparent loss of revolutionary ardor, the apparent disunity in the Bloc and movement, the apparent preoccupation of the communist states with fratricidal struggles, and the advent of détente all pointed to the same conclusion. The Cold War was over. The new situation seemed to demand accommodation and a positive response to communism rather than the old forms of resistance and containment. The effect on Western policy formation. During the Cold War, when the threat of communism seemed dangerously acute, traditional national differences between the Western powers were to some extent subordinated to the common interest in self-defense. From 1945 to 1949, Western Europe was recovering from the devastation of the war. American superiority was unquestioned. Europe was dependent on the United States to restore its economic life and protect it from Soviet attack. By the mid-1950s, the situation was already changing. Europe was on the road to recovery and was beginning to see itself as a community of rapidly advancing economic powers. Resentment of American influence was growing. Especially in France, there was a demand for a more equal partnership with the United States. In October 1958, General de Gaulle addressed a memorandum to the American and British governments asking in effect for the creation of a triumvirate of powers with worldwide responsibilities. The memorandum reflected the changing economic realities in Europe. Given a clear-sighted and realistic common assessment of the long-range communist problem, the required adjustment of relationships within the Western alliance, based on the principle of equal partnership, might have been achieved. As it was, the alliance was allowed to drift. At the same time, changes began to appear in the communist world that, distorted and exaggerated by communist disinformation, indicated a reduction in the immediacy and intensity of the threat from communism. The argument for sacrificing national interests for the sake of Western unity and defense was weakened. If the communist monolith was disintegrating into a set of rival national regimes, whose national interests were increasingly overriding their supposedly common ideology, the nations of the West could afford to revert to the pursuit of their traditional national interests in their particular spheres of influence. It was no longer necessary to strengthen Western unity under American leadership. It was more important to examine possible new alignments. The developing nations were no longer frightened into joining Western-backed military alliances. They could pursue their independence more effectively outside, or in active opposition to, the alliances while seeking cooperation with the communist countries. If communist ideology was a declining force, then Western ideological anti-communism of the Cold War variety was outdated. It would serve only to blight the growth of nationalism in the communist world and drive the increasingly independent communist regimes back together. The new look in the communist world dictated a re-examination of traditional Western concepts. The world could no longer be simply divided into two antagonistic blocs divided neatly along ideological lines. Given Soviet commitment to détente and peaceful coexistence and given the existence of the Sino-Soviet split, the concepts of East-West ideological competition and the global containment of communism seemed obsolete. They could endanger peace or provoke a Sino-Soviet reconciliation. Unity in Western military, political, and economic policies toward the Bloc had become superfluous even before it had been achieved. The new situation called for flexibility and freedom of initiative. Different schools of thought developed on how best to take advantage of the new situation in the communist world. If nascent differences between the communist states were to be encouraged, differentiated approaches to them were needed. Bridge building with those East European states showing liberal or independent tendencies would help to wean them away from the Soviet Union. At the same time, it seemed necessary to encourage closer Western relations with the Soviet Union to stimulate the process of internal evolution and to exploit her differences with China, in other words, to play the Soviet card. History, it was said, will not forgive us if we miss that chance. In the United States, some argued that the emergence of the Soviet Union and the United States as nuclear superpowers rendered the Western alliance less important. A unilateral approach to the Soviet Union was to be preferred as less complicated and less likely to provoke Sino-Soviet reconciliation. A sympathetic understanding was required of the position of liberal Soviet leaders. Their influence would be strengthened if they could be helped to solve their agricultural crises, industrial failures, technological backwardness, and shortages of consumer goods. Better fed, better housed communists would be more satisfied and less revolutionary. The extent to which Khrushchev was accepted as a liberal in the West was illuminated by the widespread Western fears of a reversion to hardline Soviet policies provoked by the news of his dismissal. In 1964, in the relief that ensued when it became apparent that détente and peaceful coexistence would continue, another school of thought in the United States contended that the West should not seek actively to exploit the Sino-Soviet dispute for fear of achieving the opposite effect to that intended. The two communist giants were best left to fight it out between themselves. A passive policy on the Sino-Soviet split could nevertheless be accompanied by an active policy toward Eastern Europe. The continuing independence of Yugoslavia had demonstrated the success of Western policy toward her after 1948. An active trading policy in Eastern Europe, apart from being profitable, offered hopes of prizing other East European satellites away from the Soviet Union. In France, the Gaullist vision of a greater Europe stretching from the Atlantic to the Urals became a topic for serious discussion. Differences over policy toward China widened. The United States clung to the view that no concessions should be made as long as the regime pursued its radical militant line. Other countries, especially France, argued that China was embittered by its diplomatic isolation. Granted diplomatic recognition, a seat in the United Nations, and more favorable openings for trading with the West, it would evolve, like the Soviet Union, on more moderate lines. In the 1970s, the obvious Soviet military threat in Europe and open Soviet aggressiveness in Africa and Afghanistan, in contrast with China's newfound moderation, generated a new school of thought advocating closer relations with China, or playing the China card. In oversimplified form, these were some of the arguments and considerations taken into account by the architects of Western policies in the 1960s and 1970s. The major criticism of these policies is not that they were influenced by crypto-communists or fellow travelers, though this factor should not be disregarded. The policies were, in the main, honestly developed from certain basic premises, namely, that the Soviet system was evolving, that the Sino-Soviet split was genuine, and that the communist monolith was in the process of disintegration. The policies were wrong because the premises were false. They were the product of communist disinformation. The practical effects on Western policies. Apparent disunity in the East provoked real disunity in the West. Antagonisms and disputes between the Western allies came out into the open. For a while, they made headline news. Soon they were accepted as normal. The trend toward the pursuit of national interest was most evident in France. It entailed a sharp decline in cooperation with the United States, the adoption of a new national defense policy, a withdrawal from France's military commitments to NATO in 1966, concentration on France's leading role in the common market, and the revival of interest in her traditional allies in Eastern Europe, Russia, Poland, and Romania. The deterioration in relations with some of the NATO allies was sharp. Cries were heard of France for the French, Europe for the Europeans, America for the Americans. Suspicions were fanned that the defense of Europe was not a vital United States interest. American reactions to the reassertion of French identity and interest were not always tactful or far-sighted. The United States refused to share its nuclear technology with France. The Americans failed to consult the French adequately over the Cuban crisis. France was not a party to the Test Ban Treaty signed by the United States and Britain with the Soviet Union in 1963. The French openly flouted American policy on the recognition of Communist China. As the American military commitment in Vietnam built up, so did the intensity of West European, especially Swedish, criticism of American policy there. Franco-American hostility spilled over into Franco-British relations. Because of this special relationship, Britain was cast in the role of an American agent in Europe. Britain's application to join the common market was vetoed by France. Britain focused on relations with EFTA and the Commonwealth and on cutting back her overseas commitments. These developments were accompanied by unjustified fears of a revival of the German threat in Europe and by the questioning of the wisdom of Franco-German rapprochement, which, though desirable in the interests of Western European unity, was in itself no substitute for it. Elsewhere, quarrels multiplied. The Austrians and Italians quarreled over the Tyrol, the French and the Canadians over Quebec, Greece and Turkey over Cyprus, Britain and Iceland over fish, Pakistan and India over Kashmir and other issues. Arab-Israeli hostility reached new levels of intensity. These conflicts had their roots in historical problems that had little or nothing to do with communism. Nevertheless, the apparent weakening of the communist threat permitted a degree of indulgence in emotive nationalistic disputes that might have been more muted in the face of a common danger commonly perceived. In the atmosphere of détente NATO, which had been created to contain the obvious post-war Soviet military threat to Western Europe, lost momentum. Not only were there political conflicts among its members, but the effort to establish standardized arms and equipment languished. Joint NATO programs were stillborn or half-hearted. In 1974, Greece followed France in withdrawing from its military commitments. Tension with Turkey gravely weakened NATO's southern flank. In 1965, a Western observer who, like everyone, accepted the authenticity of the Sino-Soviet split commented thus on NATO: "The basic Soviet blackmail strategy in the past decade has been to splinter NATO. This was the purpose behind the Berlin crisis. If the trends within NATO are not reversed, this objective may be accomplished, not by the more militant Soviet strategy, but by the temporary reduction of Soviet militancy, encouraging disarray within the alliance." How true it is that the use of force is often not the best strategy. The Soviets may in retrospect count the Sino-Soviet split more than compensated by a NATO split. As for the West, any breakup of NATO into power clusters, or a balkanization of West Europe, could produce miscalculations or appeasement. 3. The abandonment by the West of concerted policies toward the communist world led to changes in Western diplomatic practice. Personal contacts, including confidential talks, negotiations, and understandings between leading communist and non-communist statesmen, even if initiated by the communist side, were welcomed in the West. A unilateral approach to relations with communist countries became the norm. General de Gaulle's visit to Moscow in 1966 revived talk of the Franco-Russian alliance of the 1890s and the Franco-Soviet pact of the 1930s. The United States agreed to conducting the SALT negotiations with the Soviet Union on a bilateral basis. Regular bilateral political consultations between the Soviets and the French and Italian governments became accepted practice. In West Germany, the argument for an opening to the East gathered strength and found expression in Chancellor Brandt's Ostpolitik in the early 1970s. The Western response to China's détente diplomacy appeared not to be concerted. There were conspicuous examples of failure to consult. For example, the Japanese were not warned by the Americans of the Nixon-Kissinger initiative in China in 1971. President Giscard d'Estaing gave his allies little or no notice of his meeting with Brezhnev in Warsaw in May 1980. The widening of the range of the contacts between communist diplomats and politicians in the non-communist world was as warmly greeted as the widening of Western contacts with the communist world. With the advent of détente, Western business interests pressed for the expansion of trade with communist countries. Normally, without consultation or regard for any common Western policy or interest, individual non-communist countries took their own initiatives. Justification, if needed, was to be found in the arguments that the trade was profitable and beneficial to the economies of the non-communist world, and that it would promote good East-West relations and stimulate pro-Western, liberal, nationalistic, and separatist tendencies in the communist world, thereby contributing to world stability and peace, and perhaps in the long run to the formation of a world common market. Many Western firms, attracted by apparently golden opportunities, sent their representatives to explore the communist market. The British, having the greatest experience in world trade, took the lead, closely followed by the French, West Germans, Italians, and Japanese. The Germans, in particular, extended long-term credits to Eastern Europe, hoping, apart from making a profit, to promote independence from the Soviet Union. The Europeans and the Japanese increased their trade with China, hoping at the same time to take the edge off Chinese militancy. There was a general trend in the 1960s toward easing restrictions on trade with communist countries. The policy of limiting East-West trade, underlined in the Rome Agreements of 1958-59, was abandoned in favor of expansion. Controls on strategic exports from the West were relaxed, and major industrial plants of definite strategic importance to the communist bloc were constructed on communist territory by Western enterprises. Longer-term credits were provided. Most favored nation status was granted to additional communist countries, including Romania and, in 1980, China. The United States, which had for long opposed the expansion of East-West trade, began to change its ground. By 1977, as the President's State of the Union message for that year shows, the encouragement of trade with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe had become official American policy. Scientific and technical cooperation flourished, and the export of high technology goods, including computers, was permitted even by the United States. All these steps were taken by Western nations acting individually, with little or no consideration of the possible long-term consequences. Particular favor was shown to the Yugoslavs on the grounds that, having broken with the Soviet Union in 1948, they had established a precedent for Eastern European independence. Next in favor were the Romanians, for the very reason that they appeared to have set off on the same independent course as Yugoslavia. The Romanian Minister of Foreign Trade was received in France, West Germany, and the United States. Romania was given most favored nation status. Credit was made available to Romania more freely than to any communist country other than Yugoslavia and Poland. By the end of the 1970s, the expansion of trade and credit had allowed overall communist indebtedness to the Western world to rise to a total of about $70 billion. The growth of East-West trade had a pronounced effect on the overall Western approach to the communist world, since it built up powerful vested interests in the continuance of détente despite the growth of communist military power and other indications of aggressive communist intentions. Détente and disinformation on communist evolution provided grounds for socialist parties to view with greater favor the formation of united fronts with communist parties. Apart from improving the chances of socialists gaining power, united fronts looked like a promising device for influencing communist parties to move closer to social democracy and further from the Soviet Union. Such ideas were strong in the Italian, West German, French, and Finnish socialist parties. In general, socialist parties looked less favorably on coalitions or electoral alliances with center parties. The general leftward trend of the 1960s had a polarizing effect. It widened the gulf between conservative and progressive parties and between the reforming and revolutionary wings of socialist parties. More often than not, the moderate center suffered. The pragmatic relationship between conservative American and socialist European tendencies seemed to have outlived its usefulness. Opposition to communism in principle became unfashionable. The basic differences between democracy and communism were lost from sight. It was considered more rewarding to seek out common interests through increasing East-West scientific, cultural, and sporting exchanges that, it was thought, would contribute to the liberalization of communist regimes. In the 1960s, anti-communist writers virtually lost their admission tickets to the communications media. Their attitude was deemed inimical to détente. 4. European radio and television organizations negotiated their own arrangements with their official Soviet government counterparts. The need for anti-communist broadcast was called into question. The direct anti-communist content was drastically reduced. 5. Attention was focused instead on the Sino-Soviet split, other fissures in the bloc, and the growth of dissident movements. Official and semi-official funding of non-communist cultural and student organizations for the purpose of countering communist fronts was largely discontinued. Soviet expansionism in Africa and the intervention in Afghanistan at the end of 1979 drew attention to underlying Soviet aggressiveness. Some of the more naive Western illusions about détente were shattered. At the same time, Western reactions to the Soviet action demonstrated the extent to which vested interests in détente had been built up in the West, not least in West Germany and France. Despite American opposition, the West Germans and French have shown themselves determined to proceed with the construction of a gas pipeline from the Soviet Union to Western Europe. It is doubtful if the Afghan situation will alter long-term Western attitudes to détente any more than did the Cuban crisis of 1962. It has not dissipated long-term Western expectations, fostered by 20 years of communist disinformation, that the decay of ideology and the growth of internal opposition will lead eventually to the liberalization of the Soviet regime. Meanwhile, China's vigorously expressed hostility to the Soviet Union offers apparent prospects of alliance with the West on the basis of a common interest in containing Soviet expansionism. Because there has been no understanding in the West either of disinformation or of long-range communist policy in the scissors strategy, playing the China card is now regarded as a serious strategic option for the United States. Conclusion. Communist strategic disinformation has had a profound influence on international relations. Western governments and their professional advisors have remained oblivious of the problem. The fundamental purpose of the disinformation program has been to create favorable conditions for the fulfillment of long-range communist policy. The communist strategists have achieved their purpose thus far by misleading the West on developments in the communist world with three main aims in view: to relieve Western pressure on the communist regimes while they are building socialism, and laying the groundwork for an eventual worldwide federation of communist states, to provoke the Western responses they desire to their activist diplomacy and international communist strategy. and to prepare the ground for a major shift in communist tactics in the final phase of policy in the 1980s. The success of the communist disinformation program has engendered a state of crisis in Western assessments of communist affairs and therefore a crisis in Western policy toward the communist world. The meaning of developments in the communist bloc is misunderstood and the intentions behind communist actions are misinterpreted. Enemies are accepted and treated as though they were allies of the West. The Soviet military threat is recognized, but the strategic political threat is not comprehended and is therefore underestimated. Communist political offensives, in the form of détente diplomacy and disarmament negotiations, are seen as indications of communist moderation. Communist strategy, instead of being blocked, is unwittingly assisted by Western policies. The first communist strategy of strengthening and stabilizing the bloc politically and economically has been assisted by Western economic aid and by the acceptance of détente and cooperation with communist governments. By responding favorably to communist initiatives on SALT and collective security in Europe, the West has helped the communist strategists to prepare the ground for the dissolution of NATO and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Europe. By accepting Yugoslavia as independent, the West has given her the opportunity to organize much of the Third World into a socialist-oriented bloc with a pro-communist, anti-Western bias. By accepting Sino-Soviet rivalry as genuine and considering China as a possible ally against Soviet expansionism, the West is creating opportunities for the construction of new alignments that will rebound in the long run, to its own detriment. By engaging in SALT talks and agreements with inadequate awareness of communist long-range policy and strategy, and by providing advanced technology first to the Soviet Union, then to China, the West has helped to shift the balance of military power against itself. Failing to appreciate the control over communist intellectual and religious figures and taking détente at its face value, the West has been ready to accept the notion of a long-term evolution of communism and its ultimate convergence with the democratic system. The West has assisted communist ideological strategy by its own unilateral ideological disarmament. The spurious notion of a common interest between the United States and the Soviet Union against China in the 1960s was deliberately contrived and successfully exploited in the interests of communist strategy. The same can be said of the common interest between Eastern and Western Europe in seeking collective security against West German revanchism and American interference, or the common interest between communist and developing countries in the struggle against imperialism, or the common interest between China, Japan, and the West in resisting Soviet expansionism. Even the genuine common interest between the Soviet Union and the United States in avoiding nuclear conflict has been successfully exploited to swing the military balance in favor of the communist bloc. The Western strategy of a mildly activist approach to Eastern Europe, with emphasis on human rights, is doomed to failure because it is based on misconceptions and will lead ultimately into a trap when a further spurious liberalization takes place in Eastern Europe in the final phase of long-range communist policy. Not the least disturbing aspect of the present crisis in Western assessments and policy is that, if it is recognized at all, its causes are misunderstood. As matters stand, the West is acutely vulnerable to the coming major shift in communist tactics in the final phase of their policy.